Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderley. This hour on the program, we'll find out how you can give the animal in your life the best life possible. My guest this hour, animal scientist Temple Grandin, reminds us that we know a lot about what an animal needs physically, like food and water and exercise and veterinary care. But what about a good mental life? What does an animal need to be happy? This hour, we'll find out about the mental welfare of our dogs and cats and our farm and zoo animals as well, what they need to be free from fear and distress, and how we can help them express the behaviors that are normal to their species. Temple Grandin is professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She has spearheaded reform of the quality of life and humaneness of death for farm animals. My guest is one of the most accomplished and well-known adults with autism in the world, and she offers remarkable insights into animal behavior from her unique position at the intersection of autism and science. Temple Grandin's new book is Animals Make Us Human, subtitled Creating the Best Life for Animals. Welcome back to Open Line, Temple Grandin. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
And we're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to call in, you can email brief comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. Temple, you mentioned in terms of the mental welfare of animals, that animals indeed have emotions. And you say, in fact, they have the same core emotions as human beings.
Well, the core emotional systems that drive behavior are located down in the base of the brain, in the primitive parts of the brain that all mammals have. And these were originally cataloged by a neuroscientist named Jack Panskap. And they are fear, that motivates an animal to avoid predators. They are rage or anger. They're separation anxiety. This is what happens when a dog gets left home alone all day. And they're seeking, goal-directed, you know, attracted to novelty, you know, bring the dog into a new place and he's got to sniff everything. That's seeking. And then you also have emotional systems for nurturing the young, sex, and play.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the human being, of course, these are expressed in a much more complex manner because of the much bigger brain. But the emotional drivers down the base of the brain are the same.
Very similar indeed. Well, let's talk first of all about dogs. You say they're hypersocial and hypersensitive to everything that we do, and they want to please us.
Well, that's one of the reasons why you can train dogs. I mean, one of the things that's so wonderful about dogs is that they will do things for you because they want to please for social rewards, which would be praise and stroking. Where a cat, on the other hand, you have to train with food motivation. Clicker training works really well with cats, where the sound of a click is associated with food, and he does it for the food motivation, not to please you.
So if you're attempting to train a cat and you say and the cat does something you would like and you say, oh, good kitty, or stroke him, that's not going to have much of an effect.
That doesn't do it. What you have to do is you train the cat that a clicker is associated with getting a treat, and you give him a click, and you end up putting him on what's called a variable reinforcement schedule. You know, he doesn't get a treat every time he gets clicks, but he knows that clicks are equal to getting treats. And so the motivation for the cat then is food motivation. And we talk about this in the cat chapter in Animals Make Us Human.
Yes. Well, what's interesting to me, but you mentioned that dogs are so hypersensitive to everything that we do, that they're the one animal that we know of that can, if we point at something, they will look and follow the pointing finger out to what we are pointing at, or they will follow our gaze to see what we're looking at, and other animals can't do that.
Well, and the wolf has more difficulty doing it. I mean, we have selected dogs to be these hypersocial. We've also neotenized the dog, which means we've bred them to retain more puppy-like characteristics, like the problems you have with separation anxiety where a dog is left home alone in an apartment while you're at work, that crying and whimpering, that's puppy behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the toy breeds have more problems with that because they're more neotenized.
Well, what does a dog need from us?
A dog needs lots of play. A dog needs lots of walking and interaction. And one of my big concerns today, now that we have so many leash laws, like here in Fort Collins where I live, you have to have your dog on a leash unless he's at the dog park or in your own yard. You can't have him off the leash like in a field, even if you're right with him.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that this causes is dogs aren't getting socialized to other dogs. And they aren't getting socialized to other people. And I think this has actually made some of the dog bites worse because it's very, very important that puppies learn what toddlers are because animals are visual thinker. They think in pictures, and they've got to learn that little person is a person too, and it's not prey.
Yeah.
And they need to learn, you know, puppies need to be taken over to daycare centers and gently petted by little kids. As dogs have got to learn that toddlers are people and you don't chase them.
So something like we have here in Columbus, we have dog parks where people are free to bring their dogs unleashed and mingle with other dogs and other people. That's a very good idea.
I think it's a really, really good idea. You know, but today, you know, like in my town, for example, where the dog's life is so controlled, to give a dog a good life, you've got to spend at least an hour a day with the dog, playing with him, walking him, exercising him. A lot of dogs don't get enough exercise, and that also on high-energy dogs causes a lot of behavior problems. And I had an interesting time in England. When you go to the regular dog park, and this was just last year, you're allowed to have your dog off the leash in the regular park, not just the dog park. As long as he's there, you're with him, and he's under voice command control.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, tell me about play for a dog. I mean, what constitutes play, and why do they need to play?
Well, all animals play, and it's driven by one of the subcortical primitive brain systems. And play's fun. You know, you play tug of war with your dog, play fetch with a dog. You know, those are some of the things you can do. You know, stroke them, pet them, teach them tricks, take them for good long walks. You know, since the dog's life is more controlled, you've got to, you know, you got to spend more time with him. And, you know, what if you do have to leave your dog, you know, home alone when you're at work? Well, one thing you might do is if he's one of the ones that whines when you're not there, and he's not going to whine when you're around. You have to get some other neighbor to tell you how much he whines. Maybe leave him at a neighbor that stays home during the day, or take him to a dog daycare, or some place to let you take your dog to work. Europe, they're much more cool. You can take dogs in restaurants and have them with you more.
Yeah, notice the dogs in the restaurants in Europe. At first, it's a little disconcerting, but then you just become accustomed to that, and they're usually very friendly dogs.
They're usually just fine. I was talking to a friend in New York, and there's a blind person, because a service dog is allowed in the restaurant, and that service dog just loves to eat bubble gum off the bottoms of underneath the tables.
So the restaurant appreciates that.
Yeah, he cleans bubble gum off the underside of tables.
Yeah. I want to talk about seeking behavior, because this is something that animals have, and I guess we have too.
And, you know, a high-seeking person is the kind of person that wants to go skydiving and go rock climbing up on those dangerous things. That's a high-seeking person. You know, and these emotional traits, you can have high or low separation anxiety, and that's actually been demonstrated in a breeding experiment with quail. You know, you can have high fear or low fear animals. These emotional traits, there are genetic tendencies. Some dogs are real high energy, others are not.
Mm-hmm. Is this consistent within a breed? I mean, can you say that Dalmatians are generally high energy, or there could be individuals? I guess it could.
There's
be.
A lot of individual variation. I mean, getting back to the separation anxiety, there's some dogs that handle being home alone fine. They just lay around all day. I mean, so much of it gets down to the personality of the particular animal. Now, some breeds tend to be more hyper than others, but within a breed, there's a lot of variation. I mean, take Labrador, for example. You can get that heavy set kind of lab. Yeah. That's just real happy to be there with his master, real sedentary, you know, staying with the wheelchair. And then you get those long, lanky, frisky labs where they need a ton of exercise and a lot of frisbee throwing, and a lot of, you know, people working with them. And there's a huge amount of individual differences. Sure. And we discussed that in the book, Animals Make Us Human.
My guest, Temple Grandin, is professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Again, her new book, Animals Make Us Human, is subtitled Creating the Best Life for Animals. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email questions to openline@wosu.org. Temple, when you say that animals think in pictures, how do we know that?
There's no other way the brain can store information. If you don't have verbal language, the only way the brain can store information is pictures, specific smells, specific sounds, specific touch sensations. In fact, this research shows that even the ant brain stores visual images. And there's a reference in the reference list in Animals Make Us Human. Animals store sensory-based information in the brain. And it's very specific. Like you were telling me before you went on the air that this dog behaved towards you differently whether the motorcycle helmet was on or off.
Yes.
But you see animals, when it comes to, let's say an animal gets afraid of something, they'll pick up on a big trait like motorcycle helmet on or no motorcycle helmet. They tend to recognize people on, you know, big cues like that. Or if something's bad, they'll go, okay, motorcycle helmets are bad. I knew a horse that was afraid of black cowboy hats. Because somebody abused him, And when he got abused, he was looking right at a black cowboy hat. So he got deathly afraid of black cowboy hats. White cowboy hats were fine.
Yeah. I've had a person in the park walking a dog tell me the dog was reluctant to approach me, and she said, "Oh, it must be because you have a beard, and this dog was at one point abused by somebody who had a beard." So
that's a common one. That's real common. Hmm. You know, beards. I hear that all the time. But you see, that's a big, obvious trait on the person, like a motorcycle helmet would be another one, or a cowboy hat, or giant sunglasses, or a beard. There was an elephant that was afraid of beards. Hmm. And they solved the problem very, very easily. They shaved the beard off the keeper, and they made sure it was stayed shaved, and everything was fine.
Well, in turn now, then, when since obviously we our dogs and other animals do not understand our words, when we look at a dog to understand it, whether it's happy, its mental welfare, what are the signs we need to look at that tell us a dog is happy?
Well, let's look at body posture. And Patricia McConnell's got a wonderful book with all kinds of diagrams on body posture. If a dog comes up to you and the tail is wagging and the entire butt is wagging too, the butt and the tail is wagging, that's a really happy dog. You can also look at the position of the mouth. If the mouth is kind of a relaxed, open position, that's really good. They get a little anxious. They close the mouth. On the cover of Animals Make Us Human, there's a picture of a dog with the mouth closed. I'm not going to say he's fearful, but he's maybe just a little teeny bit anxious. And on Animals in Translation, on the paperback, there's a picture of a dog on the cover that's got the open, happy mouth. Obviously, if the hackles are up, he's certainly not happy then. He's, you know, getting aggressive. And then you've got to watch if you've got that stiff, if they're just kind of stiff and the tip of the tail's wagging, that's not very happy. Mm-hmm. And then when they want to play, the dog puts its butt up in the air and puts its front quarters down. They call that the play bow. And he's saying, "Let's play." And these are, you know, that's an instinctual, hardwired behavior that dogs have. Cats don't do that. Mm-hmm. That says, "Let's play."
Now, sometimes when I'm walking past people's yards, a dog will rush to the fence and it will bark repeatedly at me, at the same time wagging its tail. I've not interpreted that to be friendly.
No, it's sort of a mixture. You know, you can get mixtures of emotions. You can also get it's something that happens in an animal that doesn't happen in people. Is, you know, you can have an animal like really happy 1 minute, next minute it's growling. It can switch emotions faster. Where a person, they get angry, they like stew about it. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why that happens is all those big, huge brain circuits that we have are stewing over it, where the dog just gets over it more quickly. Mm-hmm. And as a person with autism, it's been really easy for me to understand this sensory-based thinking because I myself think totally in pictures. My mind works like Google for images. See, like when you ask me about these different dogs and things, I get a picture in my mind of these things. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it in words. In fact, I imagined your motorcycle helmet as sort of a dark, you know how they do that speckle kind of, shiny, kind of dark red.
Uh-huh.
I imagined you had a dark red motorcycle helmet. Uh-huh. I don't know where I got that from, but I had to create a picture of a motorcycle helmet.
Now, tell me about some dogs, in fact, a whole bunch of them. Well, again, this is relates to a previous question. If I walk by their yard and I know the dog and I call its name, nonetheless, it barks and barks and barks and barks. Oh, but if it were outside the fence, it would come over and greet me.
Well, the thing is, animal brains set up very distinct categories. And outside the fence, it's socialized with everybody, socialized with other dogs. Inside the fence, I got to protect my yard.
Mm-hmm.
You've got two very separate categories. You can have, how do I act on the leash? How do I act off the leash? And animal brains are real big on setting up categories like that.
So it would be unwise to put your hand through the fence.
I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because when he's inside the fence, he's protecting his yard. Now, I want to warn everybody that if you have a problem with a dog that's bitten people or you're afraid a dog might hurt somebody, you need to go to a professional trainer. There's no way on where there's a danger to people that I'm going to just tell you over the radio, you know, what to do. You need to, you know, now things like separation anxiety, fear, I'll give you a lot of advice there. But if you have a big dog, especially a big dog that's bitten somebody, you need to get professional assistance on that.
Surely. Temple Grandin, Animals Make Us Human. Let's go to our callers. Hi, Connie, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know how to keep my cat off the kitchen counter.
All right.
Well, do you push him off the kitchen counter?
Yeah, I sure do, and I've been using the squirt gun on him, and he's just determined that's where he's going to be.
Well, and he's, did you ever feed him on the kitchen counter?
Never.
Never. And what's he do on the kitchen counter? Is he looking for food, or is he sleeping?
Yeah, he's wanting to look in the food and see everything that's up there.
Do you ever, Connie, give him human food?
No, except he sneaks it when he's on the counter.
Okay.
Oh, my sister, when I was a little kid, my sister didn't want to eat her breakfast, and she had a Siamese cat. And she'd get that cat, like, underneath the table, and his paw would reach up and grab her, you know, some of her egg off her plate. She was very good at feeding Simon under the table, and that certainly wasn't very good behavior. But he never, no. I didn't give him food, but he knew my sister would give it to him.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, Connie, you've pushed the cat off the counter, and you've also used squirt gun on him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He just keeps getting back up.
He sure does.
Temple, what do you think of? Is this just a very stubborn cat?
It's a stubborn cat, and one of the things you might try doing, let's try positive reinforcement for not going on the counter. In other words, in Chapter 2 of Animals Make Us Human, I discuss clicker training, where you pair a click with food. Also, Dr. Pryor's got a video called Clicker Magic. You can buy that on the Internet. And then you train the cat to go increasingly long periods of time of not going on the counter for a food treat.
Okay.
That's another approach you might try, a totally positive approach where you train, okay, you've got him and he stayed off the counter for 5 minutes, he gets a treat. And then you gradually, over a period of days, lengthen the time that he's got to stay off the counter to get a treat.
Okay. Okay.
And make the treat something worthwhile, not just his regular old boring dried cat food, but something really yummy.
Okay.
Okay.
And what's a clicker?
Well, it's just a little thing you can hold in your hand that when you squeeze it, it makes a click. You know, it's like a little party noisemaker. And the only reason for using the clicker is if you say good kitty, he could have made 5 different moves while you said good kitty. Where if you have something where you make a click, then right at the instant he's doing what you want him to do. You can train a cat to do like a dog agility class with a clicker. I mean, it's amazing. What you first do is you have to do what's called charging up the clicker, where you make the click and you feed him a treat. You make the click and you feed him a treat. So he learns the click means treats.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got to get him onto what's called a variable reinforcement schedule. And that's the same schedule that the slot machines have at the gambling casino. It doesn't give you a payoff. I'm serious.
Uh-huh.
Slot machines at a gambling casino are set up on what's called a variable reinforcement schedule. And that's going to give you the most lever pulls or the most bar press, you know, button presses.
Uh-huh.
And what you do with the clicker is you get cat, you know, he doesn't get a treat every time. But you have to give him enough treats so that he still associates the click with food. Just like the person that sits there at the casino and they keep cranking that slot machine.
Uh-huh.
Now, I can tell you as an autistic person, I think that's just stupid doing that. I'm not,
yes.
And you know, way back in the 60s, B.F. Skinner learned how to put rats in a thing called a Skinner box, and they figured out how to set up the schedule for the most bar presses in the rat. And you can use these same principles to do some very, very effective training on cats. You'll find some information in Animals Make Us Human. And you might also want to get the prior clicker magic video. You can buy it on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Connie,
all right.
Thank you. Appreciate your call.
Thank you so much.
We have an email from Steve. He says, what does your guest think about anti-pit bull laws? Are certain dog breeds not safe to live with humans?
Okay. One of the problems with banning a specific breed is the bad guys that are deliberately breeding dogs to be vicious will just ruin another breed. You know, they've been importing, you know, great big huge dogs from Mongolia and places like that and then making them bad. Now, unfortunately, there's certain lines of pit bulls that are really messed up. I've read the information on Michael Vick's dogs, and half of Michael Vick's dogs are just really scared and abused, and they could adopt them out, and they were just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half have gone to, you know, special sanctuary. They're not suitable for, you know, general adoption. And what's so bad is people are breeding dogs with 2 aggressive traits. The original pit bull was bred to be really nice to people. That's why people like them so much, and to have prey drive and attack other dogs. And then you have other dogs like Akitas and things like that that are bred for guarding, you know, to guard the owner's territory. So now you breed those two together, and you pick out the ones, if you're a drug lord and you want to be have really horrible dog, you pick out the high prey drive and the high territorial in the same dog. Now you're starting to get something really dangerous. And unfortunately, there are certain lines of pit bulls that the prey drive on the behavior test is scary. When you do the behavior test at the animal shelter, you can stick the fake hand in their food. They're fine about that. But then when they brought this toy mechanical kitten out, this one pit bull, and this is one they were going to put down, was eyes locked onto this fake cat like a radar in a really scary way. And what I think, you know, people need to do, people that really care about pit bulls, is we need to work on breeding the good ones again. Because there unfortunately are some really bad ones, and there's more bad pit bulls than there are bad other breeds on the average. I want to emphasize it's on the average. You know, there's a lot of individual differences.
What's the best, Temple, what do you think is the best, if banning pit bulls in a community is not a good approach, what's the best approach a community can take?
Well, one of the things is we need to be doing some research on developing really good behavior testing for the dangerous traits. And I had an interesting talk with, an animal trainer on how to, do behavior tests. Some dogs, they get them half-starved before they do it. That's sort of not fair, and then they might bite at the fake hand when you stick it in their feed bowl. But we need to be working on developing better behavior tests, to locate some of the dogs who truly are not safe for general adoption. Now, maybe some specially trained person can deal with them, but they wouldn't be safe to just adopt out at the animal shelter. And I want to add, there's a lot of good pets down at the animal shelter, and I'm a big fan of getting a dog at the animal shelter or a cat at the animal shelter. And the animal shelters are getting a whole lot better on temperament testing animals and matching the right dog for the right person. You wouldn't want to get a high-energy lab for somebody that's going to leave it alone in an apartment all day. That'd be a really bad choice. You might want to get some smaller dog that's kind of lazy and might tolerate the separation anxiety better.
So if a community does not want to ban pit bulls, should they have special requirements for owners of pit bulls?
What needs to be done, because I believe in trying to be very, practical about things, of course, you have to look at the history of the dog. I mean, dogs that have bitten people, you have to look at the situation.
Mm-hmm.
If an injured dog bites a person because you picked it up, that I wouldn't hold that against the dog. It's injured, it didn't know what it was doing. There needs to be a lot more scientific work on really good behavior tests, because it seems to me some of the worst dogs are highly bred for too aggressive traits, where most of your guarding breeds, I mean, you breed a German Shepherd that the police would use to be fearless. That's a little different kind of a trait than some of these dogs are extremely territorial, like chows are really territorial.
Yeah.
Well, a chow pit bull mixed with a super high prey drive and super high territorial, that's probably not going to be a safe dog.
Sure.
I mean, we need to be, people shouldn't be breeding criminal dogs. Now, one of the ways I would go about on the research would be to take a bunch of dogs that are really bad and then a whole bunch of other dogs and see how they're really different on behavior tests and really do some proper science. And this hasn't been done, and it's going to take big samples of dogs to do it. Maybe even do some gene sequencing, and because a lot of these traits, how much prey drive a dog has, is probably related to how many gene repeats he has on part of the genome. There's interesting things that people are starting to learn about this.
My guest, Temple Grandin, is professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Her new book is Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Callers, hang right on the line. We'll be back with my guest after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, web-only edition's Mexican billionaire's charity. What, if anything, can save American newspapers as they scramble to transform or die? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point. On Point begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. On Point with host Tom Ashbrook is WOSU 820's newest program, weekday afternoons at 1 o'clock. And good morning from WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get the update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up on current events or listen to a story you missed. Don't miss a beat with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to wosu.org/email. And tonight at 8 o'clock, join us as President Obama addresses the nation. Melissa Block hosts with commentary from contributors such as Don Gagne and John Itzde as the president discusses his economic recovery stimulus package. Listen to live coverage of the press conference right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast for today, sunny skies and a warm day today with a high of 58. Clouds tonight bring in the chance of rain and a low of 48 for tonight. Currently 42 degrees. Now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're finding out how you can give the animal in your life the best life possible with my guest, animal scientist Temple Grandin. What does an animal need to be happy? We're finding out. Temple Grandin, professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She has spearheaded reform of the quality of life and humaneness of death for farm animals. My guest is one of the most accomplished and well-known adults with autism in the world, and she offers remarkable insights into animal behavior from her unique position at the intersection of autism and science. Temple Grandin's new book, co-authored with Katherine Johnson, is Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email questions or comments to openline at wosu.org. Our next caller here is Tom. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Tom. Are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay. Professor Grandin, we've just had a very positive experience involving a dog in a institutional setting. In our case, it's a nursing home. And it's raised the broader question, would involving a dog in prisons, schools, churches, hospitals have a positive effect? Would justify maybe discharging them from animal shelters to accomplish the demand?
Well, there's been, I think the dogs need to go through service dog training to do these things, but there's been a lot of positive things with dogs visiting in nursing homes, hospitals, and places like this. You know, dogs, as a service dog for, autistic kids. Some autistic kids respond great to dogs. You know, some of the old people, it's really great to have a dog. There's some very, very positive things with this. I think in these settings, the dog does need to go through service dog training.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom.
Yes, but no large effort to accomplish this, as far as you know.
Well, there's a lot of service dog organizations around. I think it's the kind of thing that people are doing it, around in different communities. It's certainly not a national thing. You know, service dogs are getting more and more common. I've heard about a lot of very positive things with this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom.
Right,
thank you for your question. Temple, we have an email from Alyssa. She says, I have always had a very negative view of dog training shows such as The Dog Whisperer, and I'm curious about your opinion of these shows.
Okay, Caesar, and we just talk about him in Animals Make Us Human. I bought 2 years worth of Caesar episodes, and I watched them. And I cataloged them into three categories: successful outcomes, so-so, and bad failure. And where Caesar sometimes really works is you've got a dog that's an aggressive dog. And he goes in there real confident. And that confidence that he has, that seems to really work, and being the leader and giving him a lot of exercise. So with certain kinds of dogs, like a Rottweiler that's bitten somebody, that's where Caesar really does a good job. Where he's bad is on fear and separation anxiety. He doesn't know what to do with fear. I've seen some very bad episodes where he's just tried to force a little dog to accept having its whiskers trimmed with the scissors, and it snarled for the whole entire episode. That was a failure. Separation anxiety, he doesn't know what to do with it. You see, those are the different emotional systems. And what this brings up is that for a certain kind of dog training problem, Caesar's really good. And some of the behaviorists get too tied up in language. They say, well, they don't agree with Caesar's explanation. I said, just turn the sound off and watch what he does, because I think he's brilliant with some of these really aggressive dogs. But the little fearful dogs and the little separation anxiety dogs, he doesn't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And this brings up a really important thing in dog training. One size and one method does not fit all.
Yeah. You say that dog owners should be parents and not pack leaders.
Well, I think that it's, you see, an original wolf pack, it's a family. And where you tend to get real strict dominance hierarchies is if you get five unrelated dogs living together or wolves living together, they form much more linear sort of dominance hierarchies. And the other thing on this whole alpha leader thing is people want to get too much, well, just going to dominate the dog. And some people think that's beating it up. It's not beating it up. It's you do it with obedience. Like, let's say you got a pushy Rottweiler, and he's growled at you, and he's challenged you. First of all, you better get a professional to deal with that. But basically, the first thing you do is make it sit before you feed it, make it wait before it goes outside. In other words, it wants something from you. It's going to have to submit by doing the command first. But that, you see, that's totally social. See, some people like think, well, dominating a dog, you pick a dog up and just throw it down, alpha roll it. That's totally bad. You know, the rollover behavior is a submissive behavior. Teach the dog to roll over. You don't have to force it. You know, some of this alpha stuff, it gets into too much, using force.
Yeah. So dogs are looking to us for companionship, but also for discipline and setting limits.
Well, they need some discipline, and they need, some dogs really do need a leader. And I think Caesar's got a point about, having the dog walk beside you. I also agree with him about lots of exercise. Mm-hmm. A lot of dogs are not getting anywhere near enough exercise.
Well, and of course that gets back to the humans not wanting to give them the exercise and not wanting to do the exercise themselves, but that's certainly true in urban settings particularly. Getting back to cats, you say people make a big mistake if they think cats are solitary, self-sufficient loners. They really do have social needs. You say they need friends and they need companions.
Well, cats are more social than people think, than people realize. A cat is a lower maintenance pet. I mean, if you're going to be away at work and a lot and things like that, a lot of cats tolerate being home alone fine. In fact, our Siamese cat, all he did all day during the daytime was sleep on the warm surface of the we had a gas dryer and had a pilot light, and it had a lovely warm surface. And the cat slept on that all day, and then he was active at night.
Yeah.
And so he would be fine if he'd been left home alone during the day. And then other cats, sometimes introducing cats to each other can be tricky, and we go over that in a lot of detail in Animals Make Us Human.
Mm-hmm. You say you can't read a cat by looking at its face. The face is not very expressive. So what do you look at for judging mood?
Well, you see a dog, you can, if it just lifts and curls its lip a little bit, it's growling.
Yeah.
If it's got that open, relaxed face, it's smiling. If the butt's wiggling along with the tail, you've got a real happy dog. Cats don't have so many obvious body postures. Obviously, if he all fluffs up, he's definitely very, very scared or upset. That situation, and you don't want to have your cat, get to that situation.
Mm-hmm. So what do cats need from us? In other words, we said dogs need about an hour of attention from us at least a day, and we're talking about walking them, we're talking about playing with them. What does a cat need?
Well, when you come home from work and play with the cat, some cats like to. I like this little wand that's got like a little feather duster on the end, and you can have them chase after that. Some cats like to just get on your lap and be stroked. And you want to stroke your pet. Don't pat it. Don't pat animals.
Mm-hmm.
Stroke it. Make it feel like mother's tongue. And don't do little light tickle touches because they tend to alert and scare.
Ah, okay. So how much play does a cat need with its owner?
A lot less than a dog needs.
A lot less.
A lot less. A cat is if you've got a really busy schedule and you're going to be at work all day and the animal's going to be spending some time home alone, a cat might be a better choice than a dog.
But I mean, a cat needs what, 15 minutes of play a day?
15 minutes would be, and some cats, they really get along well with another cat. Sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed the cats seem to tire. You talked about the little feather that you can flick at a cat, for example. Anything that moves. You say they're super predators, so they like things that move.
Well, they like things they can move and attack. And it's really important with kittens to not let them, like, play attack your hands. You know, that's not a, you don't want, in a kitten, it's cute, and an adult cat, it's not cute. And so when you play with your cat, I like to get that feather duster on the wand because I want to get my hand good and far away from his claws.
Really?
And then he can play with that, he can attack it, do everything else, and your hand's good and far away from it, but the cat's having a really good time.
I notice that cats, and this may be also true of dogs, tire very quickly of a particular kind of instrument for play, like the feather, and they want something else. So it's almost like you constantly have to be renewing a different means of play.
Well, novelty.
You know,
you see, that gets back to the seeking emotion. New things are interesting. The thing about something new things are both scary and attractive. If you suddenly took the cat or the dog into a new place, he might be scared. If you just shoved him into it, like the vet's office, let's work on trying to make that be a pleasant experience right from the beginning. And one of the big problems we have at the vet's office is that slippery table, and let's get a non-slip mat on that table.
Yeah.
So the animal's not slipping and freaking out from slipping. But new things are attractive if the animal voluntarily approaches. If the animal's cornered and forced is something new, then it's scary. But, you know, that's the seeking trait, you know. And then people that are high seeking, I mean, they want to go up these, like, you know, ridiculous open rock faces. I wouldn't be caught dead on.
Yeah, right. So they're high seeking animals and low seeking animals.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely.
You see these different emotional systems. You can be high or low fear, high or low seeking, high or low separation anxiety. There's a lot of genetic variation in sort of the temperament of the animal.
And that would be true of people, too.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, people that are high seekers, and there's been a lot of research on that, sensation-seeking in people, you know, they want to do, like, these really extreme mountain-climbing things.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be caught dead doing these things. I'm too scared. I'd get too scared.
Mm-hmm. Well, me too. And a low-seeking person might be content to just not travel very much, hang around the house a lot, read.
He's just content. You know, I've found I do a lot of work in the meat industry, and it's been interesting talking to workers who gravitates towards becoming a manager. You got some guys that get in and they learn every job on the floor, and then you got other guys that just want to stay on one job, and when they go home, kick back, have a beer, and watch a game.
Yeah.
And I would be bored with that life.
Surely.
And it's really interesting. I mean, even employees in the factory, I've seen this over and over again working, you know, there's some in the first week they've learned three jobs.
Yeah.
And there's others, they don't have any desire to do that.
And this is in great part genetic.
It's part things, the whole thing about nature versus nurture, it's half and half. We're half genetics, we're half learning.
Mm-hmm.
They're both important because, I mean, let's say when the kid's little, you encourage them to, you know, explore a lot of new things. That tends to make seeking be higher. If animals and people are both genetics and learning and experience and environment. They are both really important, and that's what all the research is showing.
So when selecting a dog, as you mentioned before, it's really important that you say, well, what kind of a family do I have? What kind of a dog do we want? Do we want one that indeed is highly active? Do we want one that is very mellow and laid back? Because a dog could be too much for a family.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, take Labrador. You get, let's say it's a, you know, you got a family with a lot of kids that's you know, they're really active, and then these kind of frisky labs that just will chase the frisbee and the ball forever would be the perfect lab. But if you've got, say, an older couple, they're not going to want to go out and throw the frisbee. A heavy set lab or some other quieter dog would be a much better choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the frisky lab would be, you know, he'd be stir crazy.
Right, that's right. We have an email from Robert. Robert said, my wife and I have two Siamese cats. About 12 years ago, one of them broke its back in our backyard, and he couldn't use his back legs, so he dragged himself to our back patio, up the three patio steps, and then I saw him at the patio door and took him to the vet, and he recovered fully. Our other Siamese cat was on the patio and saw the other one in distress. My wife claims that the other Siamese had a tear in his eyes when my wife went out and picked the injured cat up. Is this possible, or did my wife imagine this?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to say.
Mm-hmm.
whether that actually happened or not. I really can't answer that.
Yeah, difficult to say. But I just want to, one final word about cats. I want to, your sentence, you say, dogs serve people, but people serve cats. What does that mean?
Well, dogs do all this stuff for you because they want to please. See, this is where the dog is a more social animal. Why do we domesticate the wolf originally? Well, we picked out the wolves that that were gentle and they didn't bite. And after about 20 generations, you select for this really highly social animal that's very aware of your gaze and your eye contact, and it wants to please you. The cat, I'm going to have to use a clicker and the food reward.
Right.
Because he's not that motivated. He's not enough motivated for stroking to use it for reinforcement for training. I mean, they're just these are species differences.
Mm-hmm.
And use clicker training. You can teach cats to do all kinds of things. They are trainable. It's a lot of fun to clicker train cats.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Temple Grandin, professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Her new book, written with Katherine Johnson, is Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. 614-292-8513 with Bruce on the line. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, great study. I was wondering if you could give us the background on how those four basic motivations were categorized, like the history and foundation, and maybe expound on that a little bit.
Oh, I'd be happy to do that. Actually, the thing that's kind of ridiculous is a lot of the research is very old. I studied about the rage cat in the 60s when I took psychology, and the way that was determined is they stuck a really fine electrode down the brain. You stimulate the thalamus, the cat goes into rage. You stimulate the amygdala, the animal gets scared. And, you know, why wasn't this research, you know, getting out where people would know about it? Well, one of the big problems we have in science is you've got neuroscience has their journals and their meetings. Veterinarians have their journals and their meetings. Animal behavior has their journals and their meetings. And nobody communicates with each other. So this literature sort of just got hidden in the neuroscience literature. Now, I want to give my co-author, Katherine Johnson, credit for digging up Jack Panskep's old book, Effective Neuroscience. It's still in print. A lot of the articles are you can get them on the Internet, but it's difficult. And Katherine Johnson came up with a brilliant idea of linking the core emotions, especially to abnormal behaviors, like a dog that licks his paw when he's home alone. That would be separation anxiety. And I thought this really, really, really makes sense. And one of the ways to get advancement in science is you've got to go across disciplines. And there's so much knowledge in neuroscience that doesn't get outside of neuroscience. The same thing in autism. I do a lot of autism talks, and, boy, I'm digging up all the brain research and putting it in my slideshows that I give the teachers to show, well, what does this mean for teaching autistic kids? And I talk about that in my book, Thinking in Pictures.
Okay, Bruce?
Great, thank you.
Good, thanks for your call. And hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have a son who's 8 and a daughter who's 5, and they're both not just afraid of dogs, but almost it's terrorized of dogs. And they've never had a bad experience. The only dogs they've ever been around have always been very friendly, but still it's almost an irrational panic or terror of these dogs. And I wondered if what your advice would be.
Well, the first thing is the dogs have never done anything scary. They haven't knocked the child over, because you can have a big friendly dog just knock a kid over, and that's
right.
Going to be
scary.
Right,
no, nothing like that.
Some autistic kids hate dogs, and the reason they hate them is that when the dog barks, it hurts their ears. So if you have a child that tends to have a very sensitive sensory system, maybe can't stand the smell of dogs, or he's afraid the dog's going to bark and it's going to hurt his ears. Because when I was a little kid, when the school bell rang, it hurt my ears like a dentist drill. And then there's other autistic kids. They get along great with dogs, and a service dog is just absolutely super fantastic. Now in their experiences with dogs, was it big dogs, little dogs? It's been
a variety. There was a friend of theirs had a chocolate lab. A neighbor of ours had a little Jack Russell. They have equal fear of both those dogs, and the little Jack Russell was a very friendly little guy.
And what do these kids say when you ask them?
They almost clam up. They understand that we're kind of beyond the chuckling and oh my phase, and it's almost very frustrating because there's certain places they can't go and people can't visit because
do they have any other fears of other things?
The average childhood things.
Well,
not,
yeah, I can
not
see that.
Nothing serious, nothing drastic like this.
Well, because my agent Betsy was afraid of dogs, because when she was a girl, she got bitten in the butt by a dog, and now she has one, and she absolutely, absolutely loves her dog now, and you know, and she, you know, was really happy when she said that animals make us human, and Animals in Translation, my other book, helped her understand her dog. You know, this is something that I probably can't, you know, we can't solve it right now. There's something. There might be an odd association where maybe the kid fell down and got hurt and the dog was just around and somehow got associated with it. You know, real little kids, just like animals, will make weird associations. You know, the dog might get afraid of the place he got hit by a car. That doesn't make much sense, instead of getting afraid of cars. And maybe something happened to the kid and the dog was in the vicinity and he somehow associates dog with this bad thing. You know, even though the dog didn't actually do something, but there probably had to be something bad somewhere. Had to get associated with dogs. And you rule out, well, they got bitten or something, you know, obvious.
Right.
But maybe some other bad thing happened, and somehow the kid associates with the dog. You know, the thing is, little kids also are sensory-based thinkers. And like an animal, will sometimes make an association with something they were looking at right at the time the bad thing happened. And maybe they were looking at a dog.
Temple, is it possible with a child who fears dogs or other animals to slowly somehow introduce them? I suppose it depends on the child, huh?
Well, yeah, you want to try to gradually, you know, desensitize it. And I was in a situation where I had to do an emergency landing in a plane, and I was white knuckles on a plane for a long time. When I was in high school, this happened, and you know, now I've gotten to where I just get on a plane like I'm just getting in a car. And one of the ways I got over it, I learned more about planes, like how the pilot will change the throttle settings, how the planes steer, and just learning more about planes. Planes went to be really cool things, because I like mechanical things, you know, and I wanted to learn more about how a plane flies and all that, and that made them cool. And now I'm not afraid of planes anymore. Other people are freaking out over turbulence, and I'm going, it's just bumps.
Yeah.
But boy, I can tell you, if there is something wrong in the plane, I know.
You know it now.
I know.
Yeah. Mark, thanks for your call. Hello, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just had a comment about using a clicker, and I was wondering if you couldn't do the same thing instead of using that little clicker device by just making the clicking sound going
in your mouth
like that.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
What
you
do
can
with
do
horses.
It with your mouth.
Okay.
You can do it with your mouth,
because you might not always have the clicker.
That's
with
right.
You.
And that's one of the things that people don't like about clicker training. You can do it with your mouth, and if you're really good at doing clicks with your mouth, then that's going to work fine. The important thing is that you need a little sound that's really quick, so that, because if you just say good dog, he's made five moves while you're saying good dog. Where a click, you can give it right at the instant that he did the thing he wanted.
Okay.
Thanks, Beth. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Temple, we have just about 5 minutes left, but I wanted to talk a little bit about farm animals and their treatment. Your chapter on chickens, the treatment of the laying hens, just sounds to me in the animal industry, farm industry, horrific, really.
Well, laying hens is one of the big problem areas. I mean, cattle have a much better life. Cattle, whether they're naturally raised or commercially raised, you know, when they're done right, they have a decent life. And I think they have a better life than some of these dogs whining and chewing themselves up in apartments. The egg-laying hen is the food animal that's got the most problems. And when I first started working for McDonald's with egg layers, this was 10 years ago, I was horrified at how jam-packed they had them jammed in the cages so tight that when they laid down at night, they were on top of each other. There's also genetic problems where, you know, he pushed the hen to lay tons of eggs. And when they selected that hen to lay all these eggs, she became really hyper, you know, and her feathers, you know, became poor. There's problems with pushing the animal's biology to the point where the animal's falling apart.
Yeah.
We're getting more and more productive in the dairy cow. And there are some advantages to productive dairy cows, because you need less land and less cows to get the same amount of milk. And Cornell did a study on that. But there's a point where you push to the point where it's the animal is just coming apart. You've just overloaded that biological system, and that can be a major welfare problem. You know, lameness, skeletal problems, metabolic problems. They just get all kinds of problems. And I can tell you, pet dogs, some of those purebreds have got some awful problems with the skeleton and other parts of them.
Mm-hmm. Are people in the agriculture industry, you mentioned you work for McDonald's, I guess they've got some standards they set forth for their suppliers.
Well, I worked on, 10 years ago, I worked on implementing the McDonald's standards for slaughterhouses, and I developed a real simple objective scoring system. Instead of somebody going out to slaughter plant saying, well, I think this plant's good or bad, we scored them. How many cattle did you stun on the first shot? How many cattle fell down during handling? How many cattle are bellowing their heads off when you handle them? I mean, these are things that I can measure, and then I can tell, is the plant getting better or is the plant getting worse? And having scores with numbers, and in Animals and Translation, one of my earlier books, I discussed this system in detail. I also have a lot of information on my website, Grandin.com. It's just my last name, Grandin.com, Grandin.com. I have whole sections on slaughter. People mm-hmm. want to read that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about zoos. Have we made a lot of progress in keeping animals mentally healthy in zoos?
Yes, zoos have made lots of progress. You know, some of the new exhibits, really do replicate a natural environment. You know, some of the like chimpanzee exhibits are really nice. Elephants are still a problem area. Big cats, they need the fun things to do. And I thought it was really interesting. Went to one zoo. They'd strung up a cable across the exhibit, and they could do like giant cat toys.
Hmm.
And they put a box of meat on this thing, and they'd bounce it up and down, and let big kitty kill it and pounce on it, and they'd drag it away and make them chase it. And the tiger was having a good time killing a box of meat that the keeper was jiggling around on this cable thing.
Mm-hmm. But I guess you do see zoos that aren't so progressive, where you still see big cats just pacing back forth in their cages.
That is bad. And you see those big tigers, I mean, that's a nomad animal that in the wild, it walks big distance.
Mm-hmm.
So he's seeking, but his seeking emotion is turned on. This is where Katherine Johnson really brilliantly just, took Jack Panskap's Effective Neuroscience book and said, let's look at how these abnormal behaviors, the tiger's doing it for seeking. The dog that's licking his paw and maybe biting himself and tearing up the house while you're away, that's separation anxiety. And then the little gerbil that kept digging and digging and digging was doing it for fear, because that animal wants to get under something because it's out in the wild, aerial predators get it. You need to figure out what's motivating the behavior. And the seeking kind of animals, we've got to give them stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. So if you see your animal, your dog or your cat, indulging in a repetitive behavior that seems a little strange, you really want to consider that this might be an abnormal behavior.
I'm especially concerned if your dog or cat is injuring itself in any way. I mean, I talked to one lady at a book signing. Her poodle had rubbed its hair off because she left it in an airline crate all day, which I thought was terrible. I think animals need to travel in crates. I think crate training is important, but you don't leave them in there 23 hours a day like Supermax prison.
Yeah.
If your animal is doing any damage to itself physically, you've got a problem and you need to do something to correct that. And dogs that just chew up an entire house, and I'm not talking about puppies, I mean adult dogs that will just chew up a house, that's usually separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, why do they do this repetitive behavior? It calms them down.
Sure.
It calms them down. It's like taking a drug. When I was a child, I used to do repetitive behavior. And when I first started doing it, fear drove it, because like a sound would hurt my ears, and I'd start dripping sand through my hands. And then after a while, I'd just get to studying every little sand grain, get hypnotized by it. It calmed me down. Hmm. But if I'd been allowed to do that, I wouldn't be on the phone now doing an interview. I don't know where I would have been.
Temple Grandin, professor of animal science, Colorado State University. Her new book, Animals Make Us Human. Temple, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
News is next on WOSU 820, NPR News, Columbus.